All right. Good morning, friends. Did everybody get a handout in the back there? I'll talk more about this at the end. There's just a few books that I just grabbed off of my shelf that I have as references. There are, I just want to promote these three, my new favorite ones for children. If you have any kids, I bought these for my grandkids. But these are really cool books from tiny theologians about God's omnipotence, God's omnipresence, it's just really cool. Omniscience. It talks about, this one is, does God go on vacation? So this is all about, where is God? There's one, did God learn his ABCs? And it's about God's omniscience. And then there's one, does God take a nap or does God sleep or something like that? And it's about God's, just his power, omnipotence. So anyways, so there's some books in the back. If you want to, we can talk about them at the end, but I want to make sure that you're aware of that. And again, hopefully you got a handout. Let me tell you what we're not going to talk about in this session. This is not a session about, we're not going to talk about dinosaurs. We're not going to talk about the age of the earth. What I really want to do is talk about this question. How do you, in your own mind, but also talking to other people, reconcile this idea that faith in science or faith in reason don't go together, and how you respond? Does that make sense? So let me just tell you quickly a story from my own life. When I was 19 years old, I went to go work at a summer camp, and I grew up in Southern California. This is in Northern California, and I met an amazing girl, and who's now my wife, but I was so smitten, I transferred to Auburn. So I'd never been to Alabama specifically. I think I traveled through. She grew up in Auburn, Alabama, because her dad taught at Auburn University. And what I quickly learned in the state of Alabama is, you have to make a decision. Are you for Auburn or are you for the University of Alabama? Like, there's no middle ground. You can't be neutral. Like, everybody wants to know. And a lot of times it's based on where you were born, or did you live closer to Auburn or closer to Birmingham? All these questions. But I learned, like, these are like polar opposites. You have to pick one, okay? And of course, I picked Auburn. But if she was in Tuscaloosa, I would have picked the University of Alabama. Really matter to me. But I was like, this is crazy where you have to decide. And here's what I want to talk about today. There is a lot of pressure that a lot of Christians feel on this topic that you have to pick one. And that if you increase, you know, your knowledge in the sciences, then you decrease faith. Or if you increase faith, if you're really full of faith, you really don't need reason. And they're in conflict. And so what I want to talk to you about today is, how do you reconcile these two? What does the Bible have to say about that? And then how do you even bring up the subject of science? Because we love science. Science is our ally. A couple other breakouts are going to talk about science. And we'll look at some scientific evidence. But I want to make sure that you understand the goal of today is, how do you respond to this idea that you've got to pick between these two? And the good news is you don't have to do that. You don't have to check your brains at the door to become a Christian, commit intellectual suicide. Like the Bible says, love God with your heart, soul, mind, and strength. God invites Isaiah, come let us reason together. So this is something that is unfortunately a caricature of us as Christians. That's just not true, that we're not supposed to use our brains. So if you look in your outline, you just have a really quick introduction, some opening thoughts. Why do we need apologetics? Brett mentioned it a little bit, that we're supposed to have an answer. 1 Peter 3:15 talks about giving an answer or a defense. That's where we get the word apologetics from, 1 Peter 3:15, by the way. But here's the two main reasons we need these. One is, people have unanswered questions, which is really important. You got questions. Why should we believe in the Bible, or that God created things, or that Jesus rose from the dead? But then, this is true for a lot of believers, people have unquestioned answers. And what I mean by that is, a whole lot of people, they know the right answer that maybe got them through Sunday school and youth group and like in Christian circles. Like, yes, that's the right answer. But they don't know how they got there. They've never thought, they've never been challenged. And so both of those are why we need apologetics, okay? I'm going to mention a lot of this. Brett mentioned some of the concept of the word worldview. My basic working definition that I always go back to, it is your presuppositions. And we're going to see how this plays out when we talk about science. Your presuppositions about reality and morality. So we know what a presupposition is, right? Presuppose. It's your assumptions ahead of time. That's what a presupposition is. So everyone has a worldview. Now here's the challenge. Everybody thinks with their worldview, but not a lot of people think about their worldview.
And there's this idea that you've got this unbiased scientist walking into the lab doing his experiments with no presuppositions. That's not true. Everybody has a set of assumptions that they bring to anything that they're looking at. So I put a pair of glasses on there because it's like the way you're viewing everything is filtered through your worldview. And that affects your actions, obviously. But everybody has a worldview. There's one worldview that's kind of pantheistic, that God is everything, everything's spirit. There's another worldview, naturalism, which we'll talk about here, that everything is just matter. The Christian worldview says there's both the physical and the spiritual world, okay? Those aren't in conflict with each other, but that's our basic worldview. The reason it's important, your worldview, you can also think of it as kind of a guide or a map on how you get through life. Last fall, we surprised my two little boys and we took them to Disney World. They'd never been before. I grew up, like I said, Southern California, going to Disneyland, okay? In fact, I recently found a ticket stub for my sophomore year. Guess how much Disneyland cost? $17. $17 just to get it. Isn't that crazy? Anyways, when we walked around Disney World, we had a map actually on our phone, and the reason you have a map is it's telling you, this is going to show you how to navigate through this world that you're in right now. Okay, now, I'll tell you this. In my mind, because I grew up going there, I had a mental map of Disneyland. So for the most part, I didn't use my map that was part of Disney World, but there was a few times when I was just wrong because I was going off of one map that didn't match reality. Like something was in this area, but it wasn't the exact area, and then I had to go back to the map and figure out, oh, they've moved it, or it's different here. Or Disneyland has a big thing called the Matterhorn, this big mountain right in the middle of the mountain. But here's what would be crazy is me trying to walk around Disney World with a Six Flags map, right? Like imagine that. Like I would be really confused the whole day. Maybe every now and then things would overlap. Like, oh, there's restrooms right here like it says there. Maybe there's a main thing down the middle. But it would be really confusing to be trying to navigate in the world of Disney World using a Six Flags map. So this is the deal we're going to talk about today. Is naturalism the best map for us to navigate through this world? The idea that matter's all there is, that that's just what we got to go by, it's only what we can observe with our senses and experiment with, right? Is that the best map for the world we live in? Or are there other things that show up in this world that that map can't help us with? Okay, that's going to be the big issue today. So on your outline I have right there, this gets back to this issue of what is the best explanation for the way things are. Is the naturalist worldview the best explanation that only science can tell us the way things are? The way I think of it is this. There are basically five areas that that you've got to deal with. And that is origin, like how did we get here? How did just anything come into existence? Design, why do things appear to be complex and orderly and intricate and designed, right? Even like a code with DNA. How did life get here? Like just all of a sudden things are living. Like how in the world did that happen? And then you get to these other things like, but is there any meaning? Okay, is there any point in us being here? Like you can figure out like how something happened, but why is it there? That's a whole nother question. And then morals. Can you have morals? Like real morals that apply to all people if your worldview is that, well, matter's all that exists. My personal conviction, based on everything that I've studied, is that Christianity is the best worldview when it comes to answering all five of these. That you don't have to make up stories or go against what you can observe or logically it makes sense or that you give a foundation for morality. All of those things are answered best, I think, in the Christian worldview. Okay? So let's jump into this discussion on faith versus science. A number of years ago, Time Magazine had this article, God versus Science, and it was this little interview between Richard Dawkins and Francis Collins. And I just want you to notice this. Do you recognize already what it sets up for you as the reader? You already sense this sense of conflict, right? Like, you've got to decide, what are you going to be? Is it I pick God or I pick science, right? And that's what's going on in our culture, that you've got this pressure on you that, well, I'm going to pick God, and so I'm just going to ignore all the evidence that that science can offer. Richard Dawkins, I mentioned him a little bit, has said, faith is the great cop-out The great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. And here's his definition. Listen to this. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. So that's Richard's definition as a scientist. Now, unfortunately, the church sometimes reinforces this conflict. There is a church marquee, and this is one of my pet peeves, by the way, church marquees. Reason is the greatest enemy that faith has. Like, there's times when I'm driving by and I see a church marquee, and I'm like, no, no. And I feel like pulling over. I can go inside, like, who put that out there? Like, I feel like so many times. This is a good example where I'm like, no, that's sending a message that, again, you have to pick. Like, am I going to have faith? Am I going to have reason? Okay? Even the newest movie of Indiana Jones, you can even see this in the trailer. He says this, I've come to believe it's not so much what you believe, it's how hard you believe it. That's all that matters. You talk to some people, why do you believe Christianity is true? Okay? Why do you think the Bible is God's word? And you'll hear things like this, because I believe it's God's word. That's scary, because what that's saying is, the reason it's true is my belief is what makes it true. And that's not biblical. That's not the way God calls us to think, but that's what you run into. So on your outline right there, is there an apparent contradiction? I mean, is there a real contradiction? Do you have to choose between science and religion? So let's start off with this. This is why I wanted you to look closer. We're going to do a little interaction here. How can we know something is real or true? So there's a whole bunch of different ways. So let's get some ways that we can know something is real or true. Pardon? Okay, you observe it. You see it. You use the five senses. Great. That's the way we live a majority of our lives. You can know that. Any other ways? Tradition. Okay, tradition. So there's like, pardon? Okay, they'll play a role. Like, this is what a lot of people have believed for a reason. I heard another one. Pardon? Okay, you can test it. You can repeat it, right? That's the big thing with, ever remember your sixth grade science, when you had to do a science project? It was the first time I had to do like your hypothesis, your study, then you repeat it, right, and test it. So you test it. There's a problem sometimes, though, when if you've got a historical event that you can't go back and repeat. So you can't use the scientific method. I just got done celebrating 30 years of marriage. You can't scientifically go back and somehow prove that I was married on June 12th, 1993. Right? So we use other ways of knowing, okay? What are some other ways of knowing? History, okay? So there were people who saw it happen a while ago. Other ways? Any other ways? Witnesses. Okay, witnesses. That's a big one. We're going to look at the book of Acts. That's a huge one. So if you wanted to prove that I got married 30 years ago, well, we can't go into the lab and repeat that event, right? But you could interview people that were there. You could look at church records. You could look at photographs, right? There's other ways of knowing. Anything else? Other ways you know stuff? Okay, this is good. Let me submit really three more ways. Personal experience. I don't need any scientific experiment or history or anything to know that I was married on June 12th, 1993, because I was there. Okay? I experienced it myself. Another one is just intuition or conscience. So let me give an example. Could you prove with a scientific method that the Holocaust was morally wrong? I mean, how is science going to tell us whether or not it was wrong or that torturing children for fun is wrong? Like, that's an extreme example, but it's one of those things where you go, I don't need to go in a lab to prove that torturing children for fun is wrong. You just know it. Like, there's something wrong with you if you don't see it. We kind of use words like that, right? One other way of knowing, and this is important for our view, and that is revelation. That if we believe that there is a God and he has revealed stuff supernaturally to us, okay, that's another part of our faith, we would say revelation is another way that we know some things that we couldn't naturally know, like what's the afterlife like, or, you know, what's our real problem in the world called sin. Like, how do we know those things if God didn't tell us? So those are all ways of knowing, all right? Here's the issue that we're going to run into. Science is one of those ways, and it's really great, it's really valid, but as we just saw, scientifically, we can't go back and prove with a scientific method a historical event, right? Scientifically, we don't need to show that some things are really just wrong, like we know that they're wrong, okay? So that's an example there where science is a way of knowing, but is not the way of knowing, okay? There's other things that we talk about that are real or that we can experience, like the scientifically you can talk about why the sun goes the way it does and the planetary motion and stuff for a sunset, but science can't tell us, but why do we find sunsets beautiful? It just can't help you in that area, okay? It can tell us, you know, how life exists and things like that. It can tell us, but does life have meaning? Is it a purpose? So science can't help us in every knowledge, okay? However, there's people who disagree with that. Naturalists would say things like this. Peter Atkins said, it is not possible to be intellectually honest and believe in gods, and it is not possible to believe in gods and be a true scientist. Steven Weinberg, the world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done and may, in fact, be our greatest contribution to civilization. Richard Lewontin said, the problem is to get people to reject irrational and supernatural explanations of the world, the demons that exist only in their imaginations, and to accept a social and intellectual apparatus, science, and he uses a capital S on purpose, as the only begetter of truth. So what these men are saying is, this is the only way that you need to view something. This is the only way that you can know something is true. The only begetter of science, of truth, right? Now let me just go ahead and tell you this. This apparent conflict is new historically, okay? In other words, throughout the majority of history, scientists saw no conflict. So if you look at some of the greatest scientific minds that we go back to and look at their worldview, they had no problem saying, I'm a scientist, I'm a man of observation and facts, but I believe in a God who set the world in motion and we're discovering his laws that he established and explaining, we're trying to figure out how these work together. So this idea that there's always been this conflict is just not true. Like this is for the last, 400 or 500 years. And this is the important thing. These are all founders of modern science. And all of them held basically a Judeo-Christian worldview that allowed them to think there's order in the universe because of a designer. So they didn't see it as any kind of a conflict, right? Isaac Newton, for example, said gravity explains the motions of the planets but cannot explain who set the planets in motion. God governs all things and knows all that is or can be done. The most beautiful system of the sun, planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent being. This is a really smart guy, right? But he had no problem reconciling those two things together. He didn't see a conflict between faith and reason. Even Einstein, who had a very minimalist view of God, said a legitimate conflict between science and religion cannot exist. Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind. Like, he didn't see it as you got to pick one or the other. And even modern Dr. Francis Collins, okay, he was former director of the Human Genome Project. He wrote a book called The Language of God. Really, really smart guy, said, one of the greatest tragedies of our time is this impression that it has been created that science and religion have to be at war. So you don't have to have a conflict. So how do you navigate this? When someone brings up this apparent contradiction, this apparent conflict, here's what you do. You define your terms. Most people are operating, even Christians, off a faulty definition of what faith is and even their view of what science is and can accomplish for us, okay? So you've got to define your terms or else you're going to miss each other. A lot of people will define faith as just blind reasoning like Dawkins, right? That it's in spite of the facts. Don't confuse me with the evidence. I don't want to hear it, right? That is not what God calls us to. So let me read to you a passage, and then I'm going to try to define biblical faith for you. When I was director of one of Pine Cove's camps, out at our ropes course, I put the sign that said faith in Hebrews 11:1. My goal was to spark conversations about faith, because you're about to have a real, legitimate illustration where you've got to trust something. But I wanted to make sure that even when people are doubting, a lot of times this was at family camp, it wasn't the kids that were so scared. A lot of times it was the adults that you had to talk with about this. What I trained my staff to do, and this is what they learned during their ropes training, is if someone is feeling nervous about whether or not they can do this, you don't talk to them about their feelings. You know that? You don't just go like, well, let's talk about why would you feel it? What you do is in the limited time that you have, you talk about, do you know how strong this cable is? Do you know how much it could hold? Do you know how reliable this harness is? You talk about the facts that they can then put their faith in. Okay? That was the point even of me putting that there. And if you can't tell, there is a rope. He's not just pushing her off the platform, by the way. So let me read for you a definition from Scripture of faith so that you even understand this is not something biblically where it's just this blind belief that you have to have. Okay, listen to Hebrews 11:1. It says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you that word assurance. The Greek word means confidence. Okay, it means guarantee. It means proof. So already it doesn't sound like blind faith, right? Faith is the assurance of things hoped for. And again, that word hope means to place your confidence in. Our modern view of the word hope is different from the biblical view. Biblically, hope is confident expectation. It's the emotional confidence you get when you know that you've placed your faith in a trustworthy object. Okay? So it's the assurance of things hoped for. And then it says it's the conviction of things not seen. And again, that word conviction means to prove, to convince, to use evidence, right? So already you see there, the Bible is not calling us to blind faith. So here's my working definition of biblical faith is trusting in what you have reason to believe is true. Trusting in what you have reason to believe is true. So here's a good example. Jesus is in a room and a paralytic gets lowered down in front of him and he says to him, your sins are forgiven. And everybody's like, that's only something God could claim, right? Blasphemy. Jesus knows what they're thinking, so he says, okay, what's easier? Just to say your sins are forgiven because you can't see that, or to say, get up and walk. And then he says this, and this is really important. He says, that you may know, not just hope, that you may know that the Son of Man has power, the authority to forgive sins, get up and walk. He offered evidence. He offered objective evidence that everyone can see that what I'm saying is true. He didn't just say, his sins are forgiven, trust me. That's not his attitude. If you look at Acts 17, one of my favorite sermons by Paul, do you guys know where Paul is? All through the book of Acts, you look at Paul and it says he went and reasoned in the synagogues. He was trying to convince people. He was using scripture, he was using reason. And he was not afraid to go into Athens on the Areopagus where all these philosophers were. Okay, there's the Epicureans that were kind of like naturalists of his day. The Stoics were more like pantheists of his day. And he had no problem appealing to general revelation, but then he said this, God's going to judge the world, and he has given proof of this, assurance of this, by raising Jesus from the dead. So what did Paul say? There's all this stuff that I want to talk to you about thinking and reasoning and stuff, but I just want to tell you, God has not just said, I'm going to judge the world one day, you just got to believe me. He has given proof by raising Jesus from the dead. So hopefully you paid attention in the earlier breakout, right? But I just wanted to make sure you understand this idea that faith is just this blind leap is not biblical. That even bugs me when Christians say it's a leap of faith. I kind of go, yeah. It makes me nervous because it makes it sound like I have no basis to do this. I'm just going to close my eyes and jump. Even in Hebrews 11, which is the whole Faith Hall of Fame, it talks about Sarah. She believed. Now here's the thing. Because she considered him faithful who made the promise. It wasn't just blind belief out there. She's like, God's made the promise and I know that he's faithful. I'm going to put my faith in him. Okay, when I was a school teacher, I used to have all of my students in my apologetics class do a trust fall. Like they literally, everybody as part of the class for a whole period, we're just going to do the trust fall. And so the class was out there and they had to do the whole like fall backwards thing. And that was to illustrate that it's not just the person trusting sincerely, it's the object of your faith. Okay? That's the important thing. So if you're doing a trust fall into the arms of a bunch of young, you know, teenage men, that a lot of times the students didn't have a problem with that. But then I said to them, what if, and I've done this recently, what if we remove those guys and I brought in my 3-year-old granddaughter alone to catch you? Is that an important change that I made there, right? Does it matter now how sincere I am that I'm going to get caught? No. I'm just sincerely wrong. Like it has nothing to do with, it's the object of my faith. I mean, you guys, I've done sincerely wrong things before. I've gotten on the wrong plane before, sincerely. Part of that would be the person at the ticket thing didn't pay attention. I accidentally one time tried to give my son eardrops in his mouth. I thought it was stomach drops, and I'm trying to put it in there. He's alive. He's fine. But my point is, I was totally sincere, but you would just say, okay, but you were sincerely wrong. So sincerity and truth don't always go together. So in Scripture, you don't get this idea that it's just close your eyes and jump. Okay? Even like, for example, the book of Ezekiel, over 60 times God says, that you may know, that you may know. All through the book of Acts, we are witnesses. Okay? So here's another faulty idea that a lot of people have. There's this idea that even in Bible times, people were just prone to believe anything. Like they're just, well, they were so gullible. They were just so prone to superstition. If you look at just the resurrection of Jesus, I just recently came across this painting. I love it. This is showing you, we've got to understand how dejected and shattered the disciples' world was when Jesus died. Okay? They didn't just go back to the upper room like, he'll come back to life. They knew dead people stay dead. Even after the women come back, they're like, what? This is another photo I love. Just the eagerness, the hopefulness, but the I'm not sure picture of running to the tomb. Okay? Then you know what it says? When they saw the empty tomb and they saw the clothes there, then they believed. Jesus shows up and he says to them, stop doubting and believe, like touch me, because they first thought, okay, I'm still not sure. Maybe this is just a ghost. I don't know. And he's like, no, touch me. Does it eat? Right? And a lot of times we give Thomas a really bad name, right? You don't want to be a doubting Thomas. We forget all the disciples doubted until Jesus showed up. Just Thomas didn't happen to be there. Okay? And when Jesus showed up again when Thomas was there, he wasn't like, I can't believe you, Thomas. You let me down, bro. He's like, Thomas, touch me. Touch me, okay? So this is where, again, we're trusting what we have reason to believe is true. So Peter, eventually, then you get to the book of Acts, and he's boldly proclaiming this Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses. They were appealing to evidence. They weren't like, hey, he's the Messiah. Trust me. You just gotta have faith. He's like, no, come talk to me about this. He started off 2 Peter, his second letter here. For we did not follow cleverly devised myths when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. But we were eyewitnesses of his majesty. For when he received glory and honor, honor and glory from the God the Father, and the voice was borne to him by the majestic glory, this is my beloved Son, with him I'm well pleased. We ourselves heard this very voice. He's appealing to eyewitnesses, right? Same thing when John starts off, that should be 1 John 1:1-3. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon, have touched with our hands. He's saying this is something that wasn't just made up. We saw it. We touched him. Okay? So you got to define faith. Then you got to define science. So let's do this real quick, and then we'll talk about how they work together. So what is science? Science is just the Latin word for knowledge. Okay? It just means knowledge. Again, we are not opposed to science. There's another unfortunate, strain sometimes of Christians like, well, don't listen to science because, science just means knowledge. A basic way to think of it is the systematic knowledge of the physical world, okay? But again, it's the physical world. And so it's great. It is a wonderful ally, but it only can answer questions in this category of the physical world. If something is outside of that category, you can call it supernatural or metaphysics or whatever you want to call it. But if you're talking about meaning or morality or justice, right? Science can help you in those areas. You can't measure out like 3 feet of love, right? Or how much does justice weigh? That's not something that you can put in a scientific laboratory. So science is a way of knowing. And again, it's wonderful, but it's just a way. There are some things that science can't answer. So it's called a category fallacy when you put something in one category that doesn't belong there, right? My son Kobe, when he was little, the one I tried to poison, when he was little, he was the king of category fallacies. We were on our way to SeaWorld. He said, Dad, how many inches does Shamu weigh? So think about that. He would say things like that. One time he said, Dad, how many miles till my birthday? Or he said, can you just give me a slice of Sprite? And I was like, okay, I know what you mean, but those are all category fallacies. You don't measure like time in miles, right? You don't measure a liquid with slicing it, and you can't weigh Shamu with a ruler, right? But here's the thing. just because you can't weigh Shamu with a ruler doesn't mean Shamu has no weight. It just means that's one way of knowing that you're putting in a different category and they just don't go together. So you can't figure out scientifically meaning or morality, or even do we have a soul? Like, scientists can do all these experiments on the human body and just go, we can't find any spot in your body where a soul could fit. You'd go, okay, a soul is a non-material thing. Same thing with God. Evidence for God has got to be inferred, or it needs to be deduced by logic, or there's design, there's order, but you're not going to bring God into the laboratory and measure him with your instruments. Okay, that's a category fallacy. So going back to science, I like to think of it as is versus ought. Science can tell us what is, it can't tell us what ought to be. Or think of it this way, science is descriptive, not prescriptive. So you got a dead body there riddled with bullets. Science can explain to you the mechanics of a gun, right? It can explain how the bullet entered the person's body, like the trajectory entered the person's body. Here's why their heart stopped beating. Science cannot tell you, should that have happened? Understand? It's prescriptive. It's not descriptive. I'm sorry, it's descriptive, not prescriptive. It can't tell you should. It's only about is, not ought. Hopefully that makes sense a little bit. But that's where you just go. There's some things that we still believe in, but science can't help us in those areas. If you've read Mere Christianity, one of C.S. Lewis's first arguments is that there's a morality, a sense of morality that we all possess, and you just need to listen to the words that people use to show that they really believe there's a real right and wrong. Hey, you shouldn't have said that. That's not fair. I was here first, right? Those are all, that's moral language that we use to show that we really do believe in an absolute truth. But science can't help us in that area, okay? So here's what I do. When people talk about faith versus science, I define faith for them, and then I say, what do you mean by science, okay? That's the third bullet point right there. And here's what I mean. There's two definitions, two ways of viewing science. Science is methodology, okay? The goal there is discovering the answers or truth and identifying ideas worth believing. Huge fan of that. I think that's what science is all about. Methodology, again, the scientific method, right? It's empirical evidence, you can repeat it, but it only deals with the physical world, the material world. The goal is let's figure out what we can establish as truth, ideas worth believing. The problem you run into is science as philosophy. This is the view about science, where this goal is getting the right kind of answers. Okay? You see the big leap we just made right there? If you're going to find science as the only way we know things, we might have a problem. Okay? If it's getting just the right kind of answers that you can only get material explanations, physical reasoning, then we might have a problem there. Because there might be things that we all agree exist, like some of the things we already mentioned, right? Love, justice, morality, meaning. We believe those things exist. How does science help us there? So science is methodology. It's great. Science is philosophy. That's part of the naturalistic worldview. And I mentioned this. I'll just kind of remind you. Naturalism is a worldview that holds that nothing exists outside of the material world. So this is where your worldview comes in, you guys. In an ideal world, our goal is we do all of the evidence and we test things and figure out what is the best explanation. Follow the evidence wherever it leads. Here's the problem. Science as philosophy will come in and say, actually, there's only one type of answer that you can get. You can only have an answer that fits within our worldview. And that's really not fair. It's setting up the argument or the rules ahead of time that's not consistent. Let me give you a silly example. I don't know if we're all Watermark fans, people here, if you go to Watermark. But you guys know who John Elmore is? Okay. I'm on staff with John. He's on the same floor with me. What if, and I've only been on staff for a year, what if I came in and in the staff handbook it said, staff rule number one, John Elmore is always innocent. And on the eighth floor, Kendall knows this, we have a refrigerator and we keep our food there and stuff. Well, what if someone comes to Blake or one of the elders and says, hey, listen, someone's stealing food from the fridge. Like they're taking food that's marked mine and it's gone and they keep doing this. And Blake says, well, find out who it is. Follow the evidence wherever it leads. And you say to Blake, well, all the evidence points to John Elmore. Like, we set up cameras, we've done fingerprints, DNA stuff. It looks like, we're pretty sure it's John Elmore. But what if Blake says, that's impossible? And you go, well, why? And he says, because of staff rule number one. You guys see the problem here? You have already decided ahead of time what some of your conclusions cannot be. Does that sound very fair? Is that going to free you to follow the evidence wherever it leads, right? If we're on the police force and I'm commissioning you to let's solve this crime, but make sure you remember it couldn't have been any of us in this room. You'd go, I thought we're following the evidence wherever it leads. You're already telling me what I can't conclude, right? So if I'm a scientist and I'm looking at the evidence and I'm going to use reason and I've already decided, though, why I know that the answer can't be God. Do you see what I just did there? I just limited the kind of questions that I could ask. I'm not actually going to be able to, because what if the evidence does point in that direction? Okay? So here's what you run into. What often happens when scientific methodology produces conclusions that don't conform with scientific philosophy? And here's the problem. The philosophy trumps the methodology. That there's even just the mention in some scientific circles of intelligent design, or maybe it was supernatural, anything like that, it's just anathema. Like, you are crucified because, well, now you're getting religious. Now you're trying to sneak in the Bible. It's like, no, it really looks like there's an intelligence here that science can't explain. It couldn't have been coincidence or chance. It just, in the natural realm, what we can observe, it just doesn't compute that it happened by itself. But if you start to go in that direction, they're like, no, we've already decided it can't be God. So that's where your hands are tied there, if you're a scientist like that, because you're already saying, like, it has to fit in this worldview. But that's just a way of knowing, the scientific way of knowing, okay? But I want you to see this, and this is by a guy named Richard Lewontin, who we quoted earlier, about science with a capital S is the only way of knowing. But listen to this admission, and then I want to kind of tell you what I think is really going on, unfortunately, in this debate. It's kind of a long quote, but I think it's important, okay? He said, we take the side of science in spite of, these are his italics, the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, remember presupposition, a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism, that's naturalism. Matter's all there is. Do you see what he's admitting here? He's saying we already have a commitment to, it's got to be naturalistic. Look what he says. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori, you guys know what that means in Latin, that's to, you've decided ahead of time, our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, moreover, that materialism is an absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Do you see what he's admitting? What he's saying here is we have created this way of knowing that we're saying this is the only way of knowing. It is not like the evidence and all this stuff compels us to come up with these answers. We are committed to there can be no divine foot in the door. We cannot allow God to be one of the options here. And he's admitting it's not because of the evidence. There's a prior commitment. So what's really going on? And this is where I just have to keep this in mind when I'm talking to people, okay? Romans 1. In verses 18 through 21 says, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And then it goes on and says, for since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature, and he uses words, he says, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So all of those words, Paul is saying, like, you can see it, you can figure it out clearly through general revelation, but what's going on there? Here's the analogy that I call the beach ball principle. If you go to a pool and you have a beach ball, okay, and you push it under the water, what does it want to do? It wants to come back up. You have to hold it down. You have to suppress it, right? And so this idea that Paul is trying to get through in Romans chapter 1 is this. Although God has clearly revealed himself, man chooses to suppress the truth to protect his own beliefs and behavior. Okay? This is what's going on. Jesus explained it in a different way to Nicodemus in John 3:19. He said, here's the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness. And it says, it's not a matter of like, well, just I'll go for the light. It's not that. It's that they love darkness. That's the problem. It's not that there's no light. Okay? That's what they're choosing. They don't want to come because it exposes their own sin. Paul said it another way to Timothy. He said, listen, the time is going to come when people won't listen, adhere to sound doctrine. Instead, to suit their own desires, they're going to gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears want to hear. And then it says they'll turn aside to myths, right? They'll turn away from the truth and turn aside to myths, okay? A myth is an invented story. And you can believe it all you want, but you're always going to be mistaken. Sorry. I'm a dad and I'm a granddad. I just get to throw those things out there. So sorry. Dad joke. Now, let me just tell you this. Science is a helpful ally, but it's not the ultimate authority. Okay? Science is great. I want to make sure you understand this. I am not, please don't walk away from here thinking that, well, I'm going to pick the side of faith. Both of these go together. Okay? Everybody has their faith in something. What we're saying is my faith is in all those ways of knowing. I'm open to like, well, what does science tell us? What does revelation tell us? What do eyewitnesses tell us? What does history tell us? What is there intuition or conscience that's just telling me that's wrong? Like, why would that be there? Like, I'm open to all of those. Science is just this one, you know, silo of knowledge, and it's great. It helps us in areas. So it's, for example, in the area of the universe had a beginning, okay? A lot of Christians used to like freak out when they heard about the word Big Bang because that's all, but no, that actually is really good evidence that the universe had to have had a beginner because the universe couldn't have been the cause of the universe. So something outside of time, space, and matter had to exist, okay? You've got the law of cause and effect, same thing that's going on there, that well, if the universe is in effect, what was the cause? The law of biogenesis, that life can't come from non-life. These are major hurdles that an atheistic worldview can't answer. Okay, just the bang, not just the Big Bang, but the bang of where did matter itself come from? Where did life come from? Where did consciousness come from? So you've got matter, physical stuff. How did it become alive? And then how did it become self-aware? Like all of those are major things that science is really stuck with. Okay, so that's on our side, that life can't create non-life can't create life. The second law of thermodynamics is a huge hurdle for the evolutionary mechanics of how you get more and more complexity over time. How do you add information? Okay? How do things go from disorder and chaos to order? That's something that we can appeal to. Design points to a designer. The more we study the cell or even at the quantum level, all of these incredible systems, even big systems, you just go, man, it looks like there's a designer there. Code points to a coder, like DNA. There's the anthropic principle that it looks like we're all just here on purpose, like everything was designed perfectly, our distance from the sun, all the tilt of the earth, the moon that we have, the amount of water. All of these things seem to point that we were here and this is designed for us, okay? All of those things are really helpful. So let's skip to the next part of your notes. Let me just mention two other objections. People will bring up, well, then who created God? If the physical world, you know, all the sin came into existence, well, then who created God? That is not, this is what I try to point out to people. That's actually a separate issue. We're talking about design. Does it look like the universe and the world and even complex things like the human eye and other stuff are designed? Who created God is an origin question, okay? But here's where we're back to a category fallacy. Because what you're saying is the physical world, it's like me asking this question. How many of these bachelors are married? You'd go, I don't think you understand the definition of the word bachelor. You're blending two things. So when you say who created God, you're putting God in the same category as the finite universe that had a beginning. So now you're back to, you're confusing terms right there, okay? You're mistakenly putting the physical finite universe that science says had a beginning in the same category as an infinite, timeless, spaceless, non-physical being, okay? John Lennox says this, to ask the question, who created God, logically presupposes that God is a created entity. That is certainly not the Christian, nor indeed the Jewish or Muslim concept of God. God is eternal, right? The Bible says from everlasting to everlasting, your God, right? He's the ultimate reality, the ultimate fact. To ask who created him is to show that one does not understand the nature of his being. Some people ask me that, I would say, well, that's not, I don't believe in that God. We don't believe in a God who had a beginning, okay? Second question is, but which God? Richard Dawkins does this a lot when you're talking about evidence and design. He goes, well, but you've got so many gods. Is it Thor? Is it Baal? Is it, you know, is it Allah? Like, how would you know? Again, notice, you're getting ahead of yourself, Richard. Like, that's a different question of who, but it's not dealing with, but are things designed? Is there a designer? The nature of the designer, you can figure that out through other things, through revelation, right? Jesus, you can figure that out through other ways to know the nature of it. It doesn't mean that we weren't designed. If we're excavating somewhere and we come across this big ancient sculpture and we don't know who it was who did it, you wouldn't go, well, I can't admit that that was designed until I know who designed it. You'd go, that's not the way it works. You can figure out that it was designed by an intelligent mind without having seen it done, okay? Any structure that you look at, a building, just because you didn't see it being built doesn't mean you can't assume, like, someone built it, right? Okay? So let's end with a balanced view of science. Couple thoughts right here. Everything that we believe as Christians, for the most part, our major doctrines are what we would call miraculous stuff. We believe in creation. We believe in incarnation. We believe in the resurrection, right? Those are supernatural things that we would call miracles that don't go against science, but they go beyond what science can prove. And again, what makes it a miracle is that it goes against what the normal way that all of life runs. But that's the definition of a miracle. God isn't bound by his creation, right? He's the one who set these laws in motion. He can intervene at any time he wants, okay? And he doesn't do it all the time. That's why it's called a miracle, because it's like, that's not how things normally go. So I would say this, miracles are not opposed to science, but are merely beyond scientific explanation, okay? Accepting miracles doesn't abandon science. It merely acknowledges the limits of science, okay? Greg Kochel, one of my favorite apologetics writers, said this: a Christian is not so encumbered as someone who's a naturalist. She believes in the laws of nature, but is also open to the possibility of supernatural intervention. Both are consistent with her worldview. She can judge the evidence on its own merits, not hindered by a definition of science that automatically eliminates supernatural options before the evidence is viewed. As a result, the Christian's bias broadens her categories, making him more open-minded. She's a greater chance of discovering truth because she can follow the evidence wherever it leads, okay? So Christianity is not in conflict. There's a conflict, but it's between two worldviews. It's not a conflict of evidence. It's in conflict of the naturalist worldview versus the Christian worldview. That's the conflict, but not the evidence isn't making us have to choose between faith and science, okay? So the object, the domain of science is the physical realm. That's great. We believe in that, but we're saying there's other ways of knowing. If you want to look at something that's a helpful website, the Discovery Institute, Stephen C. Meyer, he just wrote a book called The Return of the God Hypothesis within the last few years. There's another book by him in the back there. Those are helpful things that show a whole bunch of scientists, and not all of them are Christians, but they believe in some sort of theistic worldview in there, are saying there is an intelligence that science can't explain. Okay? All right, we just got a few minutes. Any questions, anything you guys want to elaborate on or want to talk a little bit more about in this area? Pardon?
Can you go back one slide?
Sure. Oh, the Discovery Institute. I think it's just, I don't know. Type in the Discovery Institute. I think it's discovery.org, but I can't remember. But Stephen C. Meyer was actually just on the Joe Rogan show, of all things. And it's an interesting presentation there to hear.
Changed a lot over the years. When I was in high school, I went to an engineering conference down at UT. And I was a believer at the time, but I didn't call it hostile Christianity, so I was listening.
Yeah.
One of the scientists, one of the keynote speakers, said most scientists are Christians because whatever they discover, they find somebody that already been there before them.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. On the back of your hand up, by the way, does it have. Yeah. This is modern scientists who are not atheists. Just so you know, like, it's, again, you're not crazy for believing in God. There was a quote I skipped over, but Robert Jastrow, He is an astronomer, planetary physicist, and NASA scientist. He said this, "For the scientist who has lived by his faith and the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He's about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." Like, it's just, you're coming to the same conclusions. Yeah, so again, faith and science aren't in conflict with each other. Okay, maybe we have time for one more question. Anyone? Another thought? Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. The reaction of the church
yep.
was antithetical to that, in that it's like every doctrine in the Bible is literally true. Uh-huh. In the parables, for example, were truth. Mm-hmm. So certainly truth, they weren't necessarily literal stories, but we've locked ourselves into this. We can't accept anything that Darwin said because we're looking at it completely 180 degrees the other way.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what people think they got to put their brain in the trash can.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because so now you're starting to get in more of an in-house debate on how do we interpret Genesis 1, where, and then the question is, where do you stop taking it literally, or where do you start taking it literally, because then is there a real garden, there's a real serpent, is there a real sin, is there a real flood, there's a real Adam, so you've got to back that up. But the question is, was the purpose of Genesis to be a scientific textbook for the Israelites, or an explanation of their origin and of the universe? And the answer is more explaining how, who created versus how we got here. So again, that's kind of an in-house debate. Even a lot of Christians get scared of the origin of species. If you read it, Darwin was incredibly articulate. He was incredibly observant, but all he observed was microevolution. So when people say, do you believe in evolution? We're back to definitions. What do you mean by evolution? Because we can talk all day long about incredible variations within species that are all horizontal changes. The question is, if left to itself, do things go from, you know, more higher complex species by themselves? That's something we've never observed in the laboratory. We've never been able to repeat. Obviously, can't go back and repeat the history of macroevolution. But macroevolution is what a lot of people claim that you should believe in, but then the only evidence they give is microevolution. So again, if you read Origin of Species, don't be scared. It's really fascinating, the length of the beak of the finch, how it changes in seasons and adapts. It's awesome, and that's exactly what you would expect a creator to do, is create organisms that have the ability to adapt and to change within certain, you know, parameters in order to survive. And I think a lot of Christians freak out when they hear about that. So, all right, our time is up. Thanks so much, you guys, and you're dismissed.